Hey, welcome to Sports Shrinks. This is Tiffany Brown, and I am with
Katie Steele.
And we're your hosts. We're excited to be with you and to be talking about sports and all things sports and mental health. And we've got a good show, maybe a little bit of a somber show today, but we'll talk about that more as we go. Katie, how are you doing? How are you holding up these days?
I am hanging in there. I actually thought of this community a lot this week. Camden's been on this sports league for this will be going into his third season next school year. But going into the third season, there was a parent meeting. Not going to go into the content of it, but I found myself sitting in this meeting and noticing my blood boiling, like visceral response as I'm sitting in this meeting. And I came home and I was still escalated, dysregulated. I woke up in the middle of the night, which honestly, it takes a lot to wake me up in the middle of the night. I am a pretty like solid sleeper. I woke up in the morning thinking about it and feeling it. That's what prompted me to think about you all in this community and the power as parents that we hold in terms of making decisions for our kids and sports, and kind of when you get to these crossroads of what is the best step and what do we do, and knowing like to my bones that our feelings as parents and our reactions have a direct impact on our kid. And so I was noticing and I was in it, and this is the work that I do. And then I'm also a parent, so then I live it. And interesting, I found myself on a bike ride that morning when I woke up kind of angsty, going through a process that I thought might be helpful for you all. And again, prefacing it with none of us are perfect. None of us really know. We're all just trying to do what we think is best for our kid, given the data points that we have. And so my first thing I did was just notice of taking inventory of what am I feeling? What's contributing to these feelings? I broke down and I ended up writing this when I got home of what are the facts? What do I know are the facts over the last few seasons about what has happened, how I have experienced it, what has been said, some of these things that are concrete. It's not negotiable. Those are facts. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at what are my feelings, and not that my feelings aren't valid, but naming them for what they are, right? That is my lived experience. That was what is happening within my body, so that I can delineate between the two. Both are valid, but they are different, right? And so noticing the feelings and then really spending time just peeling the layers back of what is it about this? How come I'm having a reaction? What is needed here? What do we do with this? We don't need to do anything from the hip, but pausing of kids, we want kids driving and leading and making choices. And as parents, it is our responsibility to provide boundaries and ultimately are the decision makers, which is where that power feels kind of icky. And that's what I've been grappling with a lot lately is, I don't know. We don't have a crystal ball. I'm not sure what to do. I feel that it's impactful to Camden, right? Whatever ends up coming from this, there's a direct impact on him. Keep in mind, you all, he is 9. He is not 16. He is a 9-year-old. So I thought of the stories that were shared in The Price She Pays. There were a couple of moms who shared stories about switching kids in leagues because of what they observed at the tryout process and how that felt and how their kids appeared. And so I've been thinking about that as well. Of what do I notice when Camden comes home from different activities? And what does that mean? Behaviors can be an indicator of what their experience is, because sometimes it can be hard to put words to an experience. I think about that mom who in high school had her kid removed from the hockey league so that she wouldn't convey that this is an acceptable way to be treated in throughout the rest of your life, workforce, relationship, et cetera, et cetera. So I share that in solidarity, mostly in that parents, it's hard and there are big decisions to be made. And it, you there will be times that you have a reaction, and please take a moment to sit with that and name it and notice it and break it down for yourself, because it can be a heavy lift and it's delightful. I mean, I've raved about this baseball program he's in right now, where literally the only experience is like, what can we possibly do for the coaches to show our gratitude? Because it's so amazing. And ultimately that's how we want it to be, right? Like that, showing up and supporting your kid and cheering them on and being so grateful and appreciative for the coaches is what should be embodied in youth sports, period. So here with you all, you are not alone. I am fighting the good fight with you. But I know the challenges that can come with it too. And the amazingness when it goes so beautifully, like this baseball season. So yeah, that's, I feel like that has been a big part of my week. Along with, you know, this like minor book launch we have come up in about 10 days.
No big deal. Just this book that we're trying to get out in the world. And yeah, I hear what you're saying about just the navigation as a parent and trying to figure out the right thing. And what's always so challenging is when we don't always know the right thing. The right thing isn't always plastered on the wall telling us exactly what to do. And you're doing the best with what you have. And what a gift to give yourself, but also Camden, to kind of pause and slow it down and think about all the things that you just named. So hopefully that starts to feel a little lighter. You mentioned our book launch. Yes, our book is coming out we're recording this ahead of time. You're going to, have access to this starting Wednesday, and that would be Wednesday the 12th, and the book comes out on the 18th. And so you might be listening to this actually after the book comes out potentially. And if that is the case, we just want you to know that The Price She Pays is available on all platforms. We hope that people buy it and read it. And then we really want people's reviews and feedback. Katie, I was thinking about how we've, immersed ourselves in this writing process, and thankfully have had each other along with our writer, Aaron. But it's so incredible to me to think about how many people write books on their own and don't have a co-author to banter with. And so just thanks to you and to us, I guess, for being able to do this together. And I can't imagine doing this without you. So cheers to you, and hopefully whatever we have coming our way, and we'll see where it goes.
The feeling is so mutual. I actually got asked that question in an interview, I think last week, about how the collaboration was, because there were three of us, right, working on a project. And I still pinch myself of like, that was a hefty lift that went exceptionally smoothly for none of us having collaborated it to that extent before. I mean, it really was a pretty magical process with those 9 months when we were kind of in that writing cocoon.
Also thinking about how often group projects are taxing and hard anyways, but then you add in kind of the personalities, and we just were able to just knock out the work. So listeners, let us know if you pick it up and you read it, or you hear somebody else talking about it, ask what they think. Help us kind of hear the feedback. So there's this kind of weird process of writing something, you put it out in the world, and you just hope you hear about it again, and you hear that people are reading it. And at this point, we want to be in conversation about it. So the good, the bad, the highs, the lows, we want to know about it. Well, let's check in about our par for the course. And as many of you know, we do this each show, just to specifically focus on an area in the news and talk about kind of the typical nature of it, or the par for the course, as you will. So this is going to be another conversation that's going to start out as news focused on Caitlin Clark. And actually, Angel Reese is a part of this too. But there's a lot of controversy right now in the news about the role of kind of current physicality and fouls on Caitlin. And then this other conversation that's occurring about how, what a star she is, and she doesn't deserve this, and all this kind of fanfare and in many ways protectiveness. And in one particular game, there was a pretty hefty shoulder shot to Caitlin Clark and kind of knocked her on the floor and seemed to kind of knock the wind out of her a little bit. That ended up getting called as a flagrant foul. And if you all haven't kind of seen this in the news, it's worth just a quick Google just to kind of see that play out, just to have the kind of visual of it. But I think I'm focused on this because I'm noticing how much banter there is in the news right now about the shock and awe of fouls on Caitlin and whether or not it's fair or not fair. And I want to say this for certainty. This is a pro athlete podcast. Like, we care deeply about the work that happens for these pro athletes to get on the court or the field or the pitch. I just am kind of shocked, I guess, but not shocked. That's why it's in the par for the course segment, that there's all this discussion about, oh my gosh, it's so physical. There's so much happening, almost seemingly this protective nature of whether or not it's okay or fair to be playing this way against Caitlin. She said in an interview, this is a very physical game and you're going to get pressure. This is professional basketball. Caitlin said that last week. And so I don't know. I just wanted to hear your thoughts of this, Katie, of, you know, this idea of physicality in women's sports and this kind of added emphasis right now on what that means. And, you know, right now it's focusing in on one player, which I have some thoughts about. I'll share in a minute. But I don't know. At the surface, what do you think? What do you take from that?
I mean, the very first thought when you started that popped into my head was, wow, the irony that the feedback we received was that by wanting to see mental health integration into sport, that we were motivated to make sport soft. And yet, this is the narrative that we're hearing about female athletes, right? Come on. Like, they are badasses.
Yeah.
They can handle a foul. Are you kidding me? Like, let's not discredit them. Let's not try to protect. I mean, let's protect rights. But let's not soften their game, right? Let's let them be the players that they are and own the court like they do.
It's yeah, the irony is not lost, and it's incredibly rich to be, you know, thinking about how this, you know, in one conversation, it's about don't soften the sport, don't soften the game. If we start checking in with athletes or we start talking to them about their mental health, we're going to dampen their physical spirit or their capacity to be an intense athlete. And then on the other hand, there's all of this uproar about the physicality. And granted, I mean, I think if any athlete is getting targeted in a way that is out of scope or out of bounds of kind of typical physical play, sure, there should be a conversation about it. We're talking about a rookie athlete who has come into a professional league and is getting pushed around a little bit. They're making her work for it. And it's incredible to me that the focus is, you know, this overprotection of whether or not she can handle it. And yet at every conversation, she's saying, I got it. It's fine. Like, you know, and who knows what she's saying behind closed doors, but this idea that, you know, she knows it's a physical game. It's basketball, for crying out loud. You can't move up and down the court or make your way into, you know, the key without kind of pushing things around a little bit. And so, I don't know, I've just been struck by how much of this is, you know, the shock and awe that women can get out there and play and be physical, and who also can be, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you know, a little rough with each other, or specific to being like, oh yeah, you think you're hot because you're coming off this huge season as a star player in college ball, and you're going to come into the WNBA. Like, we're going to show you how we do things around here. That's kind of part of the deal. And, you know, if she were being, I would say, like, outside of the court being targeted and pushed around in other ways, then yeah, we might have a different conversation right now. But I'm just like, I just have been laughing about it. And not because not because being rough on the court is like the best part of basketball, but because it is just generally a part of basketball.
And the scrutiny, right? Like, I think the part that is fascinating to me about this, or quite frankly, any dominant female athlete, is the nuances of the narrative, right? This, if we go with this like umbrella term of this protection of Caitlin Clark, as if she needs it, right? Mm-hmm. Versus like, wow, what a stud. What if we use similar language of how we talked about male athletes, really, right? Instead of this like undertone of female athletes is gross, it's disgusting across sport and what we expect of them and how we can dissect these different parts of them versus just letting them embody this athletic part of themselves. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So we go to all of these other layers and speculation of how she might feel. And it's like, well, let's trust her. We can only trust what she is saying. And if she's needing to have other conversations with her coach, let's give her that latitude. But right now, this is what she's saying, which to me is like, hey, media, back off. Mm-hmm. Right. I am fine. Trust her. Trust her. And trust now her and let her focus play on something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is kind of a let her play situation. There's also, you know, some other layers of this that are popping up around, you know, Caitlin's getting a lot of attention for her star power and what she's able to do, getting attention for maybe not being as good as people thought that she would be coming into her rookie year. Her stat line isn't as big as they thought it was, which, you know, I don't think any rookie has come into a professional sport and dominated the league. They're adjusting, they're transitioning. There's all these things that we already know come into play there. But I want to contrast that with the conversation that's also happening around this. If we look at what's happening with Angel Reese and the discussion about her has been, you know, she's got a bad attitude, or she there's something about the way that she presents her confidence in herself that others are presenting back a frustration or a critique about the way that she is confident. But yet the way that Caitlin is confident and the way that she kind of holds her own is okay. And I have some thoughts about that, but I'm noticing how much and again, when I say media, I'm thinking actual sports media, but I'm also thinking about like social media and how people are responding to these things and talking with each other. But there's such a clear, to me, flashing light about how different it is based on race and how, you know, as a large group of people are as fans or media focused, are looking at Caitlin Clark and just in awe of her confidence at times. And yes, noticing that she's being kind of roughed up on the court, but you know, look at her and look how she's trying. And then Angel comes around and says, yeah, she's not the only one that's bringing good attention to the league. I'm also here. I'm also doing some big things. And then gets critiqued for having that confidence. And I keep sitting with how, you know, women in sport are just damned if they do and damned if they don't. And in so many ways are not given the latitude to just be human. And, you know, so if Angel is confident and she's talking about how great she's doing and what she's accomplished, then, you know, somehow we've got to shut her down and it's not good enough and we don't like it. But then if women are not confident enough, we're talking about how they need to kind of get it together. And I'm just struck by it. It's not new. None of it is new. But I'm just struck by how much it's kind of permeating women's sports right now.
It is the double bind, right? Or scrutiny, or damned if you do, damned if you don't, of we get in there with a microscope and dissect every little detail versus letting them have their own style and their own flair and their own personality, because ultimately that's what got them where they are. So let them be who they are. And I think the best coaches are those who can accept and celebrate their athletes versus trying to conform them and contain them. Right? Of yes, there's going to be team culture, but we're basically saying like, you need to fit this box. Oh, shoot. That doesn't work for you. No, like athletes have this innate connection to themselves, and that's going to come out in a whole variety of ways. What a cool thing, and what amazing modeling for younger kids. Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't actually have to fit that box. That's great that Caitlin Clark does it that way. That's great that Angel Reese does it this way. That's great that all these other athletes convey their confidence and body themselves, sense of self, in this whole spectrum of possibility. That's the goal, right? That we can celebrate differences. Nobody says you have to do it the way Angel Reese is doing it, but let's let her do it the way that she wants to do it.
Yes, exactly. And what helps her and makes her who she is, which to what you're saying, allows her to be the phenomenal athlete that she is. What do you think,
Katie? We do expect athletes to be kind of this like superhuman, right? Of like even your Caitlin Clark comment earlier of like, we thought she'd be doing better, right? That's like the notion of like, she should be doing better. And being an athlete isn't linear, and the best athletes know that, right? So Caitlin Clark probably is aware of, okay, I have room for growth. Hopefully she's not at her max capacity right now because it's year one in the league. She's hopefully going to grow and evolve and didn't come into this already topped out. But yet as a society, if there's any kind of setback or, you know, bump in the road, then we kind of place blame versus knowing that's just part of the process. It is so fluid. There's going to be ups, there's going to be downs. Do your thing. Kudos mm-hmm. to you for sticking with that and continuing to show up and believing in yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The discussions almost seem like, you know, if someone is not number one in terms of their stat line, then they're failing. Versus, I mean, I saw a list of stats yesterday, and I don't remember the source. I feel so bad not being able to quote it here, but Caitlin's stat line was like sixth in the league right now. And I thought a rookie, oh, it was ranking rookies specifically, but sixth out of rookies, like that, I think that's pretty good. I think we can give some kudos where kudos are due. Katie, I'm curious though, from your perspective, what do you think is the fans' maybe job or responsibility in celebrating athletes for who they are and not getting caught up in the hoopla of critique and expectations?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is something I've had dog-eared of. We need to have a conversation about fanhood just in general at one of these podcasts, because I think it's like an element all of its own. And you and I have different interfaces in terms of being a fan. Like, I'm learning to be a fan through my kids, but after my experience with athletics was just not a fan because I lost so much hope in systems and things of that nature. I think, you know, it's interesting, right? Because we kind of want the edge and the grit and the involvement. And from the outside, you don't know what you don't know. I've never had a conversation with Caitlin Clark. So all of this is speculation. And I think if as fans, we can engage from a place of, we don't actually know them. This is what I'm hearing. This is what I observe from selected clips or things of that nature. But we don't have the whole context. So how can I be a fan of expand that scope so that it can be from this place of support? Not that there isn't an element of disappointment if your team doesn't win or this or that, which, you know, that's a conversation for another day. But I do believe that fans have a responsibility. That being said, like, we want it to be fun. We want it to be banter. I think the fact that sport can cultivate the sense of community for people is one of the most incredible things, right? The amount of people that'll show up to a game, that'll wear a jersey, that'll support an athlete, like, that's really, really cool. Mm-hmm. That is really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of it's why we're all here obsessed with sports and why sports gets to be what it is, and why big brands make the money that they do, because as fans, we're participating. And yeah, I think we have a responsibility to show up in a way that is positive and meaningful and gives grace to these athletes to be freaking human. I mean, it's to what you said earlier, this idea of being kind of superhuman and not having, you know, not having a hard time or a bad day or, you know, you can be a good athlete and still be, someone who fouls a lot. We have a lot, there's a lot of pro male athletes who have that type of behavior on courts, and they're often the ones that we talk about the most. So I appreciate that. I do think we should talk about fans in the future. And, you know, so if you, any listener has a question specifically you want us to address, feel free to record that and send that to us. But that's your par for the course for the day. Oh,
you and also something. Be curious for people to like notice how they engage in sport, because I think it is a fascinating thing. Like when you are a fan, what is coming up for you? Of like, again, sitting at 9U baseball, all of a sudden a 9-year-old strikes out and the collective fan goes, oh,
yeah.
It's like, what? Oh my gosh, they just struck out. Like, that's just part of baseball, my friends. Like,
yeah, so yeah.
I think even noticing some of those nuances that are just so primal, I think are just a fascinating observation. Like, how do you engage as a fan, and what is that conveying to your child as an athlete or the professional athlete that you're supporting, whether from the stands or your living room couch?
Yeah, yeah. It really quick on that, that reminds me of a time in, gosh, it was 2014. And I remember this specifically because of what was going on in my life at the time. And there was an Oregon football game, and they were playing, I think it was Arizona, and it was a night game, and they lost. And it was, I came home, and you would have thought, I mean, quite frankly, if you had no context and you just saw me, you would have thought someone died. You would have thought maybe I lost my job. You would have thought maybe I had, I mean, who knows? Like, just insert kind of big, monumental, life-altering moment that's hard. And I was on the phone to my partner at the time, and he was away at some conference or something. And I was telling him about like the loss and what happened. And I'm just like crying on the phone. And thankfully, he had the willingness to be like, okay, like, this is just football. And I could barely, I was so mad, like, you don't get me. You don't understand me. This is ridiculous. And that is how wrapped up in Oregon football I was at the time. And, you know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. And that's neither here nor there for this conversation, but we all have things that bring us into sport and attach us to teams. And, you know, oftentimes it's not about what's actually on that field. It's all the things that come with it around the rituals with our friends or our family or, you know, whatever. But, I have not had a moment like that since, thankfully. But wow, that was one for the books. That it took me like a week to get on the other side of that and then to look back and go, yeah, maybe I need to kind of get some other hobbies. This is just a hobby. And they're kids playing on a football field. They're kids. There's 18-year-old, 19-year-olds on a football field. And I'm mad now that they didn't know what I wanted them to do. So.
Oh yeah, we're talking fanhood for sure.
Yeah, we gotta have a whole series of
that's a fantastic story.
That
I'm sure is so relatable to folks. So I appreciate you sharing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a longstanding tradition with my grandpa and I where I am not allowed to call him during a major sporting event that we're both watching. So a lot of times there was a period of time where I would call him at halftime just to kind of like, oh my gosh, what did you think of that play or this play or, you know, whatever happened in the first half, to the point where he was starting to track that we would lose if I called at halftime. And so the other pieces that come with, you know, pretty intense fandom when you're talking about rituals and superstitions and things like that. So, you know, It's a deep love and fascination that we have with sport, and it's what keeps Katie and I coming back to these conversations week after week. We're going to switch gears into our topic of the day, and you know, just a bit of a warning, I guess. I don't know if I want to call it a warning. These are conversations that Katie and I are in all the time, especially with our job. But I think just for some folks to know that we're going to get into the conversation of suicide. So as we do that, be thoughtful about what that means for you. And if you need some to pause or step away because it's heavy for you, we don't really plan to get into it to that depth of any one person's story. But we are going to be talking about the phenomenon and experiences that people have with suicide or suicidality, as we oftentimes refer to it. So we don't have a listener question today. We are working off of actually a plethora of listener questions. And Katie and I have received a lot of messages on our Instagram and emails from folks asking us to comment and talk about just what suicide is in sport, how it impacts athletes, and this kind of belief that, you know, athletes aren't suicidal, or why are they suicidal, or, you know, this kind of misunderstanding of it. So it felt important to us to just kind of take all of that on into this conversation today, and really just honor the fact that, you know, this is a real story for a lot of people, where either they themselves have experienced suicide or suicidality or suicidal thoughts, or have, you know, had someone close to them in their life die by suicide. I do want to make one comment before I turn it over to you, Katie, is if anyone, as you're listening, you know, like I said, take a break, pause if you need to, but there's some really great resources that are easily available. One is to call or text 988, which is the National Suicide Support Line, or you can text 741-741, which is a really trusted nonprofit that also does responsiveness around crises and suicidality. So with all that said, where should we start?
I think one of the places that feels important to start is that oftentimes somebody who's living with suicidal thoughts, or if somebody has lost somebody in their life to suicide, there can oftentimes be this othering, right? Of, we don't talk about it. We don't really want to name it. We don't even really know how to name it. Like, is that weird to have suicidal thoughts? And I really hope through this conversation, we can create some place of belonging, at that of that there are people, athletes, coaches, who live with chronic suicidal thoughts. And it doesn't mean that you are doing something wrong. That is an experience of a lot of people. And to have lost somebody to suicide, oftentimes people are not able to name that in the same way as they're able to name if they lost somebody to cancer. Mm. And I really hope that we can see a shift in that, because grief is grief. Mm. And people, I hope people are able to have space to share their experience and to share their story around mental health, losses through mental health, because nobody's alone, yet so many people feel alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. Yeah, the likelihood that there's someone you know, or you yourself are living with kind of suicidal thoughts, there's this belief that, you know, and I think it's a misconception, or we know it's a misconception, that suicidal thoughts mean someone's actively trying to end their life or actively trying to die. And suicidal thoughts are often a symptom of, you know, a lot of other stressors, a lot of other diagnoses. And those thoughts can sometimes be intense, but they can also be fleeting and small. And, you know, and I think that can be really scary to folks who don't experience that. Or it, you know, feels confusing. And yet, as we know in our work, there are lots of people who are incredibly successful in whatever way you want to measure that, have really strong relationships, are not actively trying to end their life. And yet they live day to day with some suicidal thoughts that kind of creep up and enter their minds. And that's a tough thing to kind of sort through, I think. And even for people who are living with it, going like, why am I thinking about this right now? And I appreciate what you're saying about how important it is to just be able to be in conversation when people have experienced the death of somebody, because it is something that we tend to kind of turn away from because we don't really know how to talk about it. And yet, like you said, grief is grief. And the complicated nature of grief with suicide, of feeling, how did I not know? Or could I have done something? Or, you know, this extra layer that is confusing and distancing and hard. And yeah, I'm glad we're talking about it, at least on air. We talk about it actually quite a bit with our clients, and knowing that there's there's kind of a misunderstanding of how it shows up for athletes.
There's a big misunderstanding, and there's a misunderstanding of how it shows up for athletes and what can be done about it. So a lot of athletes in particular don't talk about it, people, but particularly athletes, because how is it going to impact their role on a team or a coaches or teammates' understanding of them as a human? And we've heard this from so many people, this belief that if they mention that they're having suicidal thoughts, the only treatment is hospitalization. And that is a treatment, but there are a lot of different forms of treatment. Hospitalization is helpful for some people, but not necessary for all people. And I think that is something I hope that can be integrated into athletic systems so that athletes aren't having to hold on to whatever is happening internally for them out of fear that they're going to be sent away, or what we've heard of, like, shipped to a psychiatric hospital and never be able to regain connection with their team. And we heard that happen for a lot of athletes, that that was a reality. So the fear is valid because they've seen that happen to teammates. They've heard those stories, and we want to be clear that there is another way. Hospitalization can be effective for some and is necessary for some. But that isn't the only treatment modality for those who experience suicidality.
And actually, the top medical organizations say that suicidality should be treated in the least restrictive way possible. And, you know, for some, that does mean being in a hospital setting because of the need for as much kind of oversight as possible in terms of not being able to maintain safety. Or needing to navigate, you know, medication or something else. But we know that people are treated day in and day out. We do that in our work in an outpatient setting or an intensive outpatient setting. And it doesn't always mean that someone has to walk away from a sport or maybe even not even have to take a break. I mean, we don't want to, that's not a prescription. That's just, there's lots of ways to treat it. And so it doesn't have to always be hospitalization, like you're saying. And I think the misconception for a lot of coaches or, you know, leaders in leagues and organizations, they're so scared of what suicide can be. So then they don't talk about it and they kind of want to ship someone off, or they want to have them go talk about it somewhere else. And that type of isolation and disconnection, and what you've talked about so frequently, Katie, this kind of what we know is protective factor of how sports can be really powerful for people, this immediate disconnection from the thing that potentially they rely on to feel the most themselves as a major part of their identity gets stripped away from them, often without their consent or even without a conversation about whether or not that makes sense for them. And that's just kind of the bold, hard truths there that I think show up in athletics.
And this is why it's so important for whole person integration into sport, right? Whether that's hobbies or mental health needs or physical health needs, we can't be expecting this athlete version to be the only version that ever shows up. That's not realistic. So how can we make sure that that whole person is being considered and that there is space for all of them? Because we do know that holding things in exacerbates them. So to be able to find somebody, and it might not be your coach and it might not be your athletic director, it might not be a teammate, but finding somebody you trust to be able to let in so that they, you can share some of the internal experience. That is a lot for one person to be holding. And we know the power of externalization and including somebody else so that you aren't on an island or in a silo, that somebody else can help hold that.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes is kind of the top intervention is not having to do that alone or sit in that alone, and for someone to be in it with you in a way where you're not judged or, you know, othered or, you know, separated from what makes you, you can be some of the most powerful kind of treatment methods. I want to share some stats because I think there's some kind of misunderstanding or maybe not really knowing some of the kind of common things that we know about suicide. It is one of, you know, the highest or leading causes of death in the United States. And so, you know, and sometimes that will tick up based, you know, higher or lower on age groups. But we do know that in terms of suicide, there's about 12.5 million people who are thinking about or considering suicide, and those thoughts popping in. And that's oftentimes what we talk about in terms of suicidality, this kind of idea that there's a relationship in some way. So over 12.5 million are in that category. And, you know, what we know in terms of some data, in terms of kind of risk of death, we know that men, at least the way that it's measured in research studies, have the highest rates of death. And that doesn't necessarily mean that men's suicide is worse than women's suicide. What that really means in terms of statistics is when death certificates are reviewed, and when deaths are understood in terms of suicide, the attempts that men often have are more lethal than the attempts that women often have. And so when we're looking at it, like specifically on that binary of women and men, the way that it's measured at these kind of large scale studies, men are turning towards more lethal methods, which makes the deaths for men much higher. There's also a significant amount of data in terms of race. And yet that should be kind of interpreted with some caution, knowing that a lot of the times the way that race is compared in research is based on some what's on death certificates and things like that. And so sometimes things are not accurate and doesn't necessarily fully represent someone's identity. But we do know that there's a higher rate of suicidality and suicide deaths for non-Hispanic American Indian and Alaska Native people. And, you know, part of that is going to be based on what it's like to live in a country or in areas that are focused specifically on, you know, a lot of discrimination and bias. We also know that in terms of rates of attempts in terms of women and men, they're usually pretty similar in terms of attempts, but just going back to what is more lethal and not lethal. So for example, and this is just speaking really matter-of-factly, you know, utilizing a lethal means versus, you know, doing something a bit more passive, and then maybe, you know, taking some pills versus all pills, for example. Age groups, and this might be shocking for a lot of people, and this does not count, you know, the types of deaths that happen with physicians, but people 85 and older have the highest rates of suicide, and actually men 65 and older have the highest rates of suicide. So adolescents, yes, are quite high, and that's important, but we oftentimes forget the experience of older adults and how they're moving through the world. And so just wanting to really articulate some of those stats and how important that is. The last thing I'll say in terms of some statistics, and this is all from the CDC, is oftentimes poisoning is what is listed as a cause of death or a type of death with suicidality. And poisoning is oftentimes kind of this large overarching category for taking, for example, medications that are not prescribed to you and things like that. So it's not necessarily like ingesting. What I always imagine when I see kind of the word poison, I imagine those old stickers that were bright green, kind of specifying something was poison. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that type of ingestion, though that certainly can be it as well. So we're talking about a large scale, like it's, you know, one of the leading causes of death in the United States. And you know, to some misconceptions, and maybe this is worth our brief kind of naming this right now, is there's a misconception that athletes or NCAA athletes have a higher level of suicide. And, you know, what I want to name about that is it is not any different than the rest of the country. So what really is needing to be looked at there when we're interpreting data, we can see things out in the world that are saying, oh my gosh, NCAA athletes have a high rate of suicide. It is high, but it's not any different than kind of what is typical for people in the United States. what I think is the takeaway there, I want to see what you think about this, Katie, is this kind of belief that people may have that sports are going to keep somebody from feeling bad feelings or hard feelings. And so this misconception that being an athlete would mean you don't suffer or you're not suicidal. And what I think those data are telling us is that athletics does not make someone immune to mental health struggles. And so we can't ignore that suicidality is a part of people's journey who are athletes in athletics, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's higher because you're an athlete.
Yeah. And I think what I appreciate about what you're saying is that all humans are dynamic, right? And if only there was one thing, if sport really was something that could prevent suicide, what a beautiful thing if we had a cure or something that we could ensure would reduce risk to that degree, right? Of something that tangible. It's not as easily, we like things that are transactional and easily quantifiable. And I think that's what leaves so many people confused or have a misconception about suicide, is that it isn't quantifiable in the way that we want it to be, right? There are so many factors that are a question mark or unknown, or what you touched on earlier of people who lose somebody to suicide believing maybe there's something I could have done or should have done or missed or whatever the case may be. And it's just so complex, but it is gutting. It's absolutely gutting. And to live with suicidal thoughts, we definitely want to make sure people have the support that they need and that they know that help really can help. There are strategies to help alleviate the acuity, right? There, you do not have to be navigating this alone. I think for those of you that don't know, Tiffany is an expert with suicide and with self-harm. And I'm wondering, Tiffany, if you can share with listeners, sometimes those get bundled together as if they're one and the same. And could you talk a little bit about that, kind of share, kind of delineate that for listeners?
Yeah, it does get bundled a lot. And, you know, part of it is because it is bundled for some people. Some people who are actively suicidal utilize kind of the strategies of self-harm to cope with that suicidality. And so often the misunderstanding is that self-harm in and of itself, you know, things like cutting behaviors or banging one's head or like intense kind of scratching and things that like of that nature are believed to be a suicidal attempt, because it's so hard for people to wrap their minds around how could you be hurting yourself or harming yourself if you're not trying to do something significant. And what we know, and anyone who experiences self-harm will tell you, is that most often self-harm is playing one of two roles. And either it is giving someone some relief, like the behavior itself, the physical sensation will decrease or the overwhelm in the nervous system. So it can bring relief to somebody in the same way that, you know, someone might take a deep breath, or the same way that, you know, like screaming can sometimes like be like, oh, okay, feel a little better now. But the act of self-harm moves the body's nervous system in a direction of bringing on that relief very rapidly. The second reason that people utilize self-harm is maybe feeling an enormous amount of numbness or kind of like disconnection, or even this, you know, kind of dissociation, or when people say kind of like, I just feel out of it all the time. And the act of self-harm can sometimes feel like I'm coming back into reality. And so the act of self-harm can be really, you know, helpful for people. I oftentimes have quite a controversial perspective about it, where, you know, I think that people do all kinds of things to make themselves feel better. Not that we're going to cheer them on to do things that are, you know, unhealthy or unsustainable, but I do think it is worth the attention of us to look at how someone was not feeling right, so to speak. They weren't feeling well, and they were doing whatever they could to try to feel different and or feel better. And So kind of all the mechanisms are there, but now we just need to kind of tinker with the mechanism so that it's something that's a bit more sustainable and healthy. But the act of self-harm itself is not necessarily suicidality or suicide attempt in and of itself. Sometimes people can be self-harming and as they're navigating life, and then they become, sometimes because of that hopelessness or despair, increase, you know, those feelings of suicide. So they can be really bundled together for people, but they can be very, very different. And when I'm teaching about it, I'm trying to get people to think about, you know, don't automatically make any assumptions, really turn towards the person who's in the pain and the suffering and ask them, what is happening for you? You know, was this a suicide attempt? Trust them if they say that it wasn't. And, you know, they're going to know best. And what we know about suicide is, you know, it's at the bottom line, suicide is about feeling such an intense amount of despair that whatever's happening, this intense amount of despair feels insurmountable. And then when we take that level of despair with a moment of impulsivity, then that's kind of this formula for suicide. Most of the people that you and I treat, and, you know, same with folks who show up in therapy centers and counseling offices, oftentimes their suicidality is coming from a place of the way life is right now isn't working for me. And I can't do it anymore. So the conditions of the way life is kind of mapped out is not working, and I need it to be different. That's usually the formula, and it's confusing, I think, to the outside world, and especially for athletes, and so they don't have a lot of room to talk about it, because for most of us, kind of what we were talking about earlier, being a fan looking in, you want to go, how in the world do you not love your life every day? You're getting to be a pro athlete or a college athlete or a star high school athlete or whatever it is. And it's hard for us to wrap our mind around the fact that they might be really, really suffering.
Thank you for that. And I do think some of the coping mechanisms that athletes are conditioned to utilize, like dissociation, right? Mm. Disconnect from self, just work harder. It can compound on itself of, why can't I just get myself out of this? If I just did X, Y, Z, and it's not that simple, okay. Right? And it's not for anybody. It isn't just being able to snap out of it or see everything that you have to live for. It's so much more complex, right? Deep despair. It isn't, there are blinders. So to try to convince somebody is ineffective, but rather to be in it with somebody and to work to understand what their experience is really the best way to show up for folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, you know, want to add to that sometimes, you know, even though we're saying turn towards, you know, someone who's suffering and talk with them and try to understand them, the other thing that has to be understood by us doing that is not everyone understands what's happening for them. You know, it's hard to explain. It's hard to know why you're having the thoughts come through your mind that you're having that are related to suicide. It's hard to know how it's connected to all the other things that are going on for you. And so, you know, sometimes it's not about being able to say, okay, well, let me tell you, first it's this, and then it's this, and then I feel this. Some people can do that and some people can't. And when we add in all these additional layers of what it means to be gender diverse, what it means to be queer, what it means to be Black or Brown growing up in a predominantly white community or have all white teammates and coaches, you know, there's all these additional layers that create isolation that are going to increase that despair. And so when we're not able to show up and recognize that people in general can be hurting, in general can have bad days, in general feel huge amounts of pain and suffering and despair, and then, you know, what we really need to be doing is extending our compassion for the fact that when there's all these other layers of pressure and isolation, that can shift really quickly into a place of feeling incredibly stuck and incredibly isolated.
I think it's so important to punctuate this notion of not asking folks why, right? Because, and we do this clinically, and one clinical tactic is most people can't answer a why question, even if it's benign. Why do you put the trash can that way? I don't know, right? On like a very basic thing that has zero impact. So to ask somebody who's experiencing suicidal ideation, suicidality, why, they will not be able to answer that question. Right? That any type of why question, instead opening that door and not expecting them to have an understanding, because that is, it isn't quantifiable in that way. So the sharedness really is in a sense of meeting them where they need to be met, not asking them to provide you with understanding that they do not have.
Yeah, that is key. I think another takeaway that I'd like for folks to just be considering is, don't ask why, and then also don't assume that because someone's having a better day, that that means that they're no longer suicidal. So we talk a lot about how things aren't linear, and the ebb and flow of suicide is really true for people. People can go to work and practice and have, you know, star-studded games or tournaments, and yet still, you know, underneath have, you know, these suicidal thoughts or suicidal feelings. And then that can shift for a little bit, and then it can come back. And so part of the compassion, I think, and part of the not asking why, and being able to show up for the people around you, is to recognize the ebb and flow of the way that it feels.
And that there is, people might get some relief and then it might come back, right? Like most mental health needs or condition or symptomology, there is, while some is chronic, there are the ebbs and flows, there are the fluctuations. And so getting understanding of what the experience is for that person versus thinking it is finite and the same for everybody, none of it is the same. Really, and nothing is the same for any person, regardless of context or content. So this is that same. Mm-hmm. Each person has an individual journey, and work to respect that and learn about it for that, mm-hmm. that specific human. Mm-hmm.
We hope that this conversation is, you know, helpful for folks, and, you know, it won't be the last time that we will talk about it. We've got some tricks up our sleeves and hopes to have more of these dialogues, and really to be able to honor the many ways that suicide shows up for athletes and on teams and with coaches and coaching systems too. So really wanting to just share our gratitude for anyone who is navigating this in their own life. We see you, we hear you, we're with you. And if you know someone who is suffering, help is out there. There's a lot of really great mental health professionals. There's a lot of great websites and crisis lines that can be found. We want to turn you towards our website, which is athletesmentalhealthfoundation.org. You can find some trainings, free trainings, that have talked about suicide and self-harm, and we definitely want you to have access to that and know that that is there. You can also find some nuggets of good information on our Instagram, which is also Athletes Mental Health Foundation. And just thanks for being here and listening. We hope that you find our book in your hands at some point soon. The Price She Pays will be out on June 18th. Thanks for being with us and having conversations with us about the concept of suicide. And we will come back to this conversation again.
Thank you all.
Thank you all.